Today's episode of The Athletic Support is brought to you by Remarkably Remote, a new daily microcast from the experts at GoToMeeting, all about making work from home work for you. With indispensable intel on how to stay sane, motivated, and productive at home, we're here to help you in this brave new remote working world. Find us on smart speakers or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. You can also listen at gotomeeting.com/tips. That's gotomeeting.com/tips.
Everybody, welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens before, during, and after the season, and also during unexpected work stoppages. I am Marc-Antoine Godin, and I am, as usual, with Arpin Basu. Arpin, how you doing, my friend?
I'm alone. I'm alone in my place. Yeah. Having fun, but we...
Well, that's not too bad.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Well, I'm not actually alone, but I am. Yeah. But we are, we're hanging out at home like everyone should. And let's just, you know, hammer home that point that everyone should be staying home. But we're lucky today to be joined by a guest. So last week on the French episode of The Athletic Support, we had Marc Denis on. And so this week for the English version, we've decided to invite Mike Johnson, who've graciously accepted. Mike, welcome to The Athletic Support.
Thanks. I appreciate the clever name. And I think it would have been way more entertaining had you had me on the French one. And, well, Marc Denis can speak English, so that wouldn't be very funny. But me doing the French have been far more entertaining.
Probably.
How's your French these days?
You know, c'est pas bien anymore. No, like I took French immersion as a kid. My mom's from Montreal. She grew up in Rosemere. You know, I had Danny Briere and Denny Gauthier for about 5 years in Phoenix as my roommates. So I would eavesdrop on their conversations every night with their family and friends, which helped me hear French. So then when I played in Montreal, which was almost 13 years ago, maybe now, 14 years ago, I could totally speak French, not well, but passingly. And I would have days where I would challenge myself to go out and, like, today's the day I will only speak French, you know, whether I'm at the bank or at the stores or whatever. And I could get by, but that was a long time ago. And so it's not what it once was, which is much like myself. Not like I once was.
Well, I think this is an excuse for you to do more Canadiens games, I think.
Listen, you guys know I'm not just saying this because I'm on here with your Athletic supporters. But doing Montreal games is great. I mean, it really, really is. It's a unique city, obviously, unique organization that I was fortunate enough to play for just 1 year with. But you can tell it's just different. When you're around the NHL, you guys know, you guys get around the NHL, now you're spoiled because you're around Montreal mostly, but it's different and different in a good way. And as far as the actual logistical broadcasting, ask anyone if you have to do a game in a booth, the best booth to do it in is in Montreal. So I have no complaints whatsoever when I get to do Montreal games.
What would you say is different? Describe different for us. Mm-hmm. What's different about covering games in Montreal? Or involving the Canadians?
Well, I mean, as far as just the actual logistically, like, it's a good booth, it's a good setup, good viewing angles, because the press box in Montreal is built like a catwalk, kind of out above the glass almost, so you're not kind of back behind the top row of the stands, you're out over top of the ice, and it's low enough you can see really well. So there's that. But to me, the difference is that it's the Montreal Canadiens, and that there's a history that goes there. I don't care that they haven't won in... whatever, since 93, I guess it's been. And when you go to the Bell Center, when you're around the Canadians, when you're around Montreal, you feel that. And that's what makes it different. You feel the history. Unfortunately, you know, if one of their greats, you know, there's been a few of them in the last few years who've passed away, you get a sense of the enormity of what the Montreal Canadiens have meant to the city of Montreal and the province of Quebec and even the country of Canada. And you get a little feel of that when you work there. And the Bell Center, great rink, sold out, good energy, smart crowd. You put all that together and it's a desirable spot to call a game.
Well, that's, you know, we actually wanted to talk to you about your approach as a broadcaster. And I think And also your one season in Montreal. So this kind of dovetails quite nicely to both those subjects. But just in terms of your broadcasting approach, I think, you know, we recently, Jonathan Willis recently did this huge sort of play-by-play rankings based on fan surveys and everything. And I think it rubbed probably some people the wrong way, but it's really what the fans thought of their local broadcasts. And you know, your name comes up often as far as, you know, one of the people that the Canadiens fans like having on the games. How would you say, what is your basically your approach to preparing to broadcast a particular game?
For preparing, you know, I try to know what's going on with the teams, both teams. I try to touch base with different members of media, coaching staff, management, players of both teams prior to going to the game. So you got a sense of what's going on. I will always try to watch the few games prior to the one I'm calling. So I'll watch, you know, the previous two or three games to get a sense of what's happened in the immediate past. I read, I don't know if you guys have access to that Sports Scan, but basically it gives you an article, every article written about every team in the NHL. So, I mean, there's, you know, 10, 20 articles per team. You get this massive email every morning. So I'll read those for a week leading up to the games, to see what is going on and to hear. I'll listen to the team websites to hear their sound. I'll read guys like you with the stuff you write. So, you know, you try to just take in as much information that you can about both teams, about what's going on, about different trends that other people are seeing. And then, you know, I do my preparation specifically for that game where I look at the stats that are right there prior to, which involves, you know, goals and assists, but also I dig in a little bit of the analytical side of things and see if there are different numbers there that I can use to make sense of a game or what's happening. And then I put all that together and I have pages and pages of notes and numbers and things that, you know, I want to be reminded of, plus whatever I retain in my head. And then I go to the game and my primary objective are two things. One, like, try to be entertaining and have a little fun. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's serious. I know it's serious, but you know, I like having fun. I like doing the job, and hopefully, you know, that can come across where it's a moment of levity, whether it's a laugh or it's whatever it might be. And the other thing, and the biggest thing, is that I try to answer the question why,
right?
In whether a macro or a micro sense, like why are things happening? Why is this guy not playing? Why have they lost? Why is Carey Price not as good as he was 2 years ago? Why? Explain to me why in a way that is understandable, relatable, and informative. And if I can do those things while having a little fun, then I probably have done an adequate job of calling a game.
Do you have an objective or an aim at developing a style or a voice that's significantly different than others?
No, only in that I wouldn't. I'm just myself. Now, I am different than others, and every one of the guys who do what I do is different. So, I have not necessarily worked as like, I'm going to be this kind of person. I'm going to be controversial. I'm going to be flamboyant. I'm going to be the numbers guy. I'm going to be the players guy. I'm going to be the old school guy. I'm just going to be me. And however I see things, whatever I find interesting, whatever I find entertaining, I try to relay that through, and hopefully that is something that people can relate to and don't mind hearing and can find informative. But it would be too hard to try to be anything but exactly who you are and do it for any length of time. Like, you might be able to get through five games trying to be somebody else, but eventually your own personality shaped through your own experience will have to come out, because, you know, I've been doing this for coming up on 10 years now, and you just can't fake it or try to be anything but your absolute truest self and do it for any length of time. So I never was advised when I first started to, you know, you should try to do this, other than, you know, you get tips, use your experience as a player, use your experience for playing in Montreal, use whatever you have to do your job and explain things. But be yourself was probably the thing that I try to do the most.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how you basically assure yourself that you are going to have, I think what makes you distinctive is what you said earlier, is that you try to do the why. I think what too many broadcasters do is they do the what. You know, we don't need you to tell me what happened. I do need to know why it happened. And it's similar to our approach as writers, is that we're often trying to do the why or the how, or, like, you know, kind of more explanatory things, but that is what makes you Like that's, but it's do you, you know, I don't know if you could put this into words, but to explain the why in real time, like as something happens, can you go like a little bit through the process of that, like how you come up with the why so quickly? Because I can spend hours looking for the why, and you have seconds to do it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in many ways that is. That's the challenging part of the job. That's what maybe hopefully I can do well is you're watching the game in its entirety. You're going into it with an open mind, and then you're trying to figure it out. And you make a great point, like the what? The pictures are the what? Like everyone just saw the goal that went in. Let's explain why the goal went in. Like, you know, look at that shot. It went in the top corner. Well, yeah, I know. My eyes work. That's why I'm watching television. It went in the top corner. Like, give me something a little bit more. Now, sometimes things are so great, you just have to revel in like, holy cow, look how great that is. But generally speaking, and I think this goes back to, again, if you were to ask anyone who's a color guy, you know, we're often shaped by our own experiences of our career. And I fashioned myself. Now, I don't know, my coaches might argue, but I thought I was a pretty intelligent player and I was kind of reliable defensively. So I could understand what was happening on that side of the puck because I paid attention to it because I was, you know, it was one of the things I was supposed to do well. But I also was a scorer for most of my career. I played in the power play, played the top six, was never a star, but always played kind of in the first top two lines. So and I guess kind of viewing the game through that big wide prism of how I played allows me to watch a game and you know, you're watching a game and you see a 2-on-1 and I'll want to do a replay. I'm like, you got to take that back to the bad pass along the boards that forced the bobble that caused the pinch that then chipped out. Then, like, you take it the four steps back. And I guess that's just how I watch it. Maybe I'm more honed into watching games that way now that I work as much as I do, as opposed to when, you know, you watch as a fan. But that's how I've always seen the game, because, you know, if I was on the ice and we got scored against, and I'd be like, I know if I did something wrong or if I didn't. And right. Even if it, you know, you might not see me in the picture of the goal, I would know, okay, I lost my back check 100 feet ago because I fell down. And you would know that. And so I knew that as a player. And I guess I pick that up as a broadcaster and I try to. But the challenge is, you're right. One, you got to identify it quickly. You need to find a replay that might show what you're saying quickly. And then you have to get that information out there in a concise manner in 15 seconds before the play gets going again, all of which can be a challenge. But with good producers, and, you know, Brian Mudrick does a great job doing the play-by-play with me, you know, you try to get it out there as quickly and as efficiently as possible.
It might be tricky sometimes because the original mistake happens 6 or 7 seconds before the goal, and you're, you know, and just trying to show it might not always be easy.
No, it's not. And it's not easy to maybe pick it out, but it's also not easy to show it. And you know, I'll ask for different camera angles or give me the high and wide camera to try to get into frame exactly where the first mistake happened that might cause that domino chain effect of ending up with a goal against. And, you know, I quite enjoy when I have a goal scored and you might see a guy right there on the back check and you're like, it's that guy's fault. Look, he didn't get his man. And if you can show it's actually not his fault, it was a bad pinch or a bad pass or a bad read, and he's trying to cover up for somebody else, but it's not really his fault. Because I'd like to think what I would say when I'm watching a broadcast or I'm doing a replay is when the coaches go in the video room and they watch the video, that's what they would say. They wouldn't say, Thomas Tatar, that's a bad back check. You weren't with your guy. They'd say, actually, Shea Weber, that was a bad pinch. You put Tatar in a bad spot. He couldn't quite catch him, but it was your fault initially, not Thomas's, even though he looks bad in the replay. And, like, you know, that kind of little bit more nuanced, little deeper view of the game, because that's probably how the players and the coaches are seeing it.
Ultimately, the fans will only blame the goalie. Anyway.
Yeah, well, Montreal, yes, they absolutely will.
They also will never. They will never blame Shea Weber as well. Like, Shea Weber does nothing wrong. So your example there is totally not realistic.
Well, but that's why I can say Shea's name, because it's very comfortable, because he never makes a mistake. That's why it's a complete hypothetical and it's not rooted in any truth. Although right. I will say this, let's be honest. Okay, so I was one of the people. You know, I was a big PK fan. We're not going to go down this road too deeply, but I was a big PK fan. I thought he was fantastic. And I was also, you know, I wasn't in the room, but I was around the room enough. And I understand personalities, but my whole take was, like, if you don't like someone's personality because he's too gregarious or he's too out there, well, like, that's probably your problem more than it is his. You got to be willing to accept different people with different personalities, especially if they play really well on the ice. And when they made that trade, I'm like, that's, you know, Shea Weber's a very good player, and it might be close to a push now, even though I thought it even, you know, PK at that point was maybe even better than Shea. You know, the way it's turned out, and I would say, like, I probably was wrong, because PK, with his health and his back and his foot speed, is his game has fallen off in a lot of the ways that people thought Shea Weber's game would fall off. Foot speed, age, injuries, although, you know, Shea's had a couple of injuries as he went, but Shea Weber has been good this year, specifically. He's been better than PK anyways, but you know, it hasn't been as bad of a deal as, you know, probably I thought it might end up being when it was made.
I think there are a lot of people in that boat, especially in the sense that we're, you know, anyone who recognized that it might be a push would think that right now is when you would start to see the separation. And you so to see PK Subban traded for essentially nothing was shocking last year. And then to see how he played this year, I mean, it's I was wrong on how I thought that would trade. And I think there are a lot of people who are wrong on how that trade would play out. But yeah, I mean, in the sense that, and in a sense of a stat, and it's funny though, like, okay, like I was making a joke, like Shea Weber never makes a mistake. He doesn't make mistakes often, but even when he does, the Canadians themselves are so unwilling to point it out, right? Just because of his stature, right? Like, he's just one of these guys who, like, he does nothing wrong, even when, you know, he's human, he makes mistakes. But in that sense, he's like the exact opposite of PK Subban was blamed for everything.
Right.
Everything that could have gone wrong, there was something that he did. And it's just one of the other things.
You know what, though? When you watch them, I mean, you're right. And part of that is personality, and part of that is Shea Weber does have the universal respect because of the kind of steady quality veteran professional that he's been his whole career. But the other part of it is that at this point, Shea Weber also knows what he's not good at, right? Like, he knows he's not fast anymore. So he does his best not to get himself in places where he's got to turn and race, because if he does, he loses that race. And you know, that would be a rare moment where it's his fault. So the mistakes that they make between PK and Shea at this point, PK still makes mistakes of being aggressive and pushing forward and trying to skate around someone or challenge someone at the blue line, where Shea's mistake, if there is one, it's like, you know, it's more born out of him backing up more often now because he can't skate quite as well. So again, it, you know, part of that is the reaction. Like, when you see a PK mistake, it would be so much more glaring visually than a Weber mistake, because, you know, he knows that he can't be that aggressive anymore because his foot speed is not his strong suit.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, that's the thing is that they were such different players then, and there were such different personalities, which I think was the main reason for the trade. But and we see it now. You know, I realized what they were doing when you just started talking to young guys on the team. And, like, you know, Shea Weber's never gonna, like, for instance, I tried to get him to tell me what team bonding event he organized in training camp, and he wouldn't tell me. And he's like, you can go ask the guys. I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to go ask the guys, and they're going to tell me. So why don't you just tell me right now? Like, why don't we just avoid this whole, this whole song and dance? Why are we bothering? He's like, I don't like pumping my own tires. That was his literal answer. And he made me go out into the room after and go around and ask guys what they had done.
Right.
And so that's like Shea Weber, like, in a nutshell, to me, is like, basically, like, he would not do that. But just moving on from this, it's we did want to talk to you about your 1 year in Montreal. And before we get to that, I decided, okay, I'm going to go look up your HockeyDB page. And it dawned on me, as a guy who has a name that no one knows and no one has ever heard before, that has its own sort of unique challenges in day-to-day life, I'm wondering, is it challenging to be Mike Johnson? Because you have 15, there are 15 Mike Johnsons on HockeyDB. Like, is there somewhat of a unique challenge to having, like, such a common name as opposed to, like, such an uncommon name like mine?
Yeah, completely. Okay, so here's some good first examples. One, you went on HockeyDB. If you could have gone on the NHL.com and typed in Mike Johnson, my stats would come up, not my picture. I work for the NHL Network. I've been in the league, around the league, like 25 years. And legit, 2 years ago, my photo wasn't on NHL.com on my stats page because it was one of the other Mike Johnson. So absolutely, I'm a little, if you see my Twitter handle, I got underscores in there and my middle initial and all kinds of stuff happening because clearly there's about 10,000 Mike Johnsons that were on there before I were. And the most important one probably, and the worst one, was when I cross the border, I have such a common name that occasionally, you know, I have every possible travel aid you can have, Nexus and this and this. But every now and then I'll get pulled in and they'll ask, you know, do you have any outstanding warrants? I'm like, no. I'm like, did you get arrested down in Tennessee? I'm like, I'm not from Tennessee. Are you delinquent in your, you know, child support payments down in Alabama? I'm like, I'm not from Alabama. I don't. And then they'll take a boat because clearly someone with my name and birthday, whatever, had done something wrong. And then It takes until they catch that guy that I basically could start going through smoothly again. So yes, my parents were not particularly creative. I'm Michael Johnson. My sister's name is Jennifer. And my parents, although we were born in the 70s, they were not doing any psychedelics when naming us. That's right.
It's like being called a John Smith or just Mike Smith, the goalie Mike Smith. Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. But you could have gone full Michael Johnson, like the sprinter. And it's we hear less of Michael Johnsons than Mike Johnsons.
Yeah, I could have gone that route, but I've never been called Michael unless I'm in trouble. So unless my mom's yelling at me and saying, Michael, it's always been Mike. So maybe it'd be bring up a bad visual by calling me Michael. But yeah, no, it is a common one, that's right. For sure.
So I did eventually pick out the right Mike Johnson, though. I did manage to find your page on HockeyDB. So yeah,
okay.
You're the only one with the little NHL logo next to it. So it makes it easy.
Okay, yeah. There you go. And what did you find? When you hockey DB'd me, what did you find? Anything interesting?
Well, I hockey DB'd you in order to get the right Canadiens roster for the year you played in Montreal. Because we want to talk a little bit about some of your teammates that year and your experience in Montreal. And so, but first of all, like before, when you were talking about, you know, how the Canadiens are just different, I've always found it striking when a player arrives in Montreal, I like to like let them, you know, spend a few weeks sort of getting into the routine and like seeing how many media are there and being in a home game and everything. And then just asking them, like, what did you think of playing in Montreal before? And what do you think of it now? Like, what is the difference between the perception of playing in Montreal and the reality of playing in Montreal? I know it's just, when you said that, I just thought of that because you only played 1 year here. What were you surprised by? But over the course of that one season?
So, you know, I'd played a few years in Toronto and I'd been in the league like 10 years when I got to Montreal. So, you know, I wasn't surprised by, you know, the volume of the media. I wasn't surprised by the fact that, you know, there might be, you know, 15 English speaking members of the media and 15 French speaking. I'd been around, I'd been in road, you know, I'd come in there with Wayne Gretzky as my coach. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd been there with Vinny LeCavalier as my teammate. Like I'd seen the dynamic of the volume of, I live in Toronto. I grew up in Toronto. I played for the Leafs. So I also know, you know, I saw it on the Toronto side of things. What struck me as different, and I say this respectfully to the Toronto Maple Leafs, who I, you know, my first team and the rest, and I'm from Toronto and everything else, is that I when I was a child, I like would skate at Maple Leaf Gardens with my minor hockey team. Like I was around the Leafs for like, you know, the 15 years prior to me playing there. And I never felt the history of the Leafs, which, you know, is not as great as Montreal's, but still pretty darn good, although it's been a long time. I never felt that history and that connection. Even when I played there in the closing of the Gardens. And I never felt the connection to the history of the Leafs even like I did with Montreal. And I think that's because there's more of it. Montreal does such a very subtle job of having it around, not driving it down your throat, not giving you a booklet, like read about all our great players. But, you know, Jean Béliveau would come in the room.
Right.
I remember when he came in, I used to sit in the old, I would sit right beside the sliding doors when they'd open up. And I'd sit there and my little corner was like Chris Higgins was right there and Garth Murray. And we just kind of like shoot the breeze in our little young guy corner or new to the team corner anyways. And then I remember one time Jean Béliveau would usually walk in. When he would come around, he'd go over to Sac or he'd go to Sheldon and talk to them. And he came over to our little corner and he said, Mike, good game tonight. And I'm like,
oh, wow.
Thank you. And I'm like, thank you, Mr. Béliveau. Like, I'm like, Jesus, wow. And like, it just like, I didn't have those kind of experience. Like Johnny Bauer was around, but it didn't, it just didn't resonate as deeply as the historical context, playing for Montreal. And so to me, that's what was different. And that's what was cool. That's why I loved it. Because you could feel it. It mattered. not obnoxiously mattered. Like, I don't need people saying, "Hey, Mike, you're great," or "Hey, Mike, you suck." It's just like, it was, you could feel in the city that it mattered. And that was, and I love that.
Was there a jersey retirement the year that you were there?
There was two, if I'm not mistaken. I think I got Serge Savard jersey somewhere in my parents' basement signed to me. And I think Ken Dryden as well.
Oh, yeah.
I think I might have had both of those.
Yeah, it was a good year.
I have jerseys for both of them kicking around somewhere.
That was
so
a good one there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's just it. You're like, oh. Well, the best part about it, you want to sum up Montreal to a T. They're like, so I get traded there. And they say, okay, what number do you want? And I was wearing 12 in Phoenix. And I'm like, okay, I'll take 12. Yeah, that's retired. Twice. So I'm like, oh, so you're saying I can't have it? Clearly you don't mind it wearing twice. Why don't you just give it to me now? But yeah, so I was, you know, they got numbers that are, players are so good, they retired the same number twice.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were traded. You were traded for a fourth round pick, but I'm sorry, but a guy who just put up 54 points the year before, in what world is it worth only a fourth round pick?
Well, I like to joke, like, I think if you looked, or if you can do the research, I think the year before I got to Montreal, I think Mike Ribeiro might have been second in scoring at 55. So I'm like, I'm effectively like the second highest scoring player on the team almost coming in. You know what? I think some of it was financial for Phoenix. I think some of it was that Mike Barnett had seen enough of me that we didn't always see eye to eye and in some things. And you know, I'd been there 5 years, maybe just making a change. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, value is what it is. You know, I was probably not shocked when I got the call in the middle of the summer and Mike Barnett said we made a trade, and I knew I was maybe going to get traded at the previous trade deadline. So, you know, I wasn't stunned. But yeah, it was, you know, I think back at those moments. So I get traded. I immediately go to the roster and I start looking at who's who, right? Like, where is everyone? Like, where will I fit in? And they traded for me, and then did they sign Sergei Samsonov like 2 days later? And he was also going to be a right winger. And I'm like, Sammy, who beat me for rookie of the year, he's like going to like my foil my whole year, my whole life. But so I'm like, okay, who am I going to play with? And it was Saku, of course, the first line centerman. Mike Ribeiro was second. Plecky, who I'd never even heard of at that point, he was so young in his career. Thomas Plekanec was third, and Radek Bonk was fourth. So I'm like, okay. I guess if I'm battling Sergei Samsonov, except he signed for like $3.5 million, I'm guessing he's going to get the second line spot and I'll take the third. I think Mike Ryder was the first line winger. And I went to skate before the season started. And you know, when you go to those skates and like, usually they're pretty loosey goosey, you know, kind of last few weeks of August, I could tell in two sessions that Thomas Plekanec was a good player. I think I probably came home and called my dad. I'm like, listen, you know who I'm going to get to play with? This guy, he wears a turtleneck. He's got a bad goatee, but man, is he a good little player. And I'm like, this is totally going to be fine. Like, we're going to be totally fine. This Plekanec guy, I didn't even know how to say his last name at that point, is going to be a good player. And we started training camp together. And I think it was like our second training camp game. I'm out there stretching at center ice beside Mike Ribeiro, and Ribs got pulled off the ice mid-warm-up because they had just traded him to Dallas for Yanni Nienaba. So then Plecky moved up to second line. Radek Bonk played on the third line. And I basically play with Radek Bonk every single day the entire season.
Yeah.
Every day in practice. Every day, the two of us, we had Per Jogan a long time, but the two of us were attached at the hip. Penalty killing, checking line from start to finish. That's what Carbo was going with. So instead of Plecky, I got Bonky. And Bonky was a pretty good player too, but Carly didn't let me produce offensively quite the same way I wanted to.
You mentioned Per Jogan. I wanted to ask you about him because that's a name that's really that's forgotten. You know, he used to be, though, he was a former first-round pick for the Canadiens. He stayed in Montreal only for 2 years. How good could that player could have been?
Great physical skills. Like, he was a heavier player, like, physically. Like, he weighed a lot. He was strong skater, and he could shoot the puck, and he was, you know, kind of one of those bulls going to the net. I played with him a lot. The game had to probably slow down for him a little bit to be really successful offensively. Like, he didn't read the plays offensively quite yet. And so he was kind of just like a straight line fly up and down the ice as fast as he can kind of thing, as opposed to kind of mixing the more subtle offensive decisions. But he had the physical tools. I don't know if he had the the kind of offensive mental reads to be a really good offensive player. And he never probably got a chance to develop that much, but man, he was strong. Like, he was like a big, strong kid.
And speaking of big, strong kids on that team, you know, with the, like, you heard a lot, like, with Kotkaniemi's struggles this year, you know, you heard a lot of people reference Guillaume Latendresse. And so you were on, like, that was his rookie year, the season that you were here. And a lot of people referenced how he was maybe rushed to the league. I'm just wondering, like, from your perspective, how you saw his experience. You know, he had the added layer of being a local Francophone player, and you know, there was a lot of pressure attached to that. But how did you, from your vantage point, view that season and how it went for him, being brought up so quickly?
Yeah, and I think that the dynamic of him being a Francophone player in Montreal was entirely different than would have been like an Anglophone, because there was so much attention on him, and he was, and I don't know, I didn't know at the time, and I don't even know now, but you know, if Montreal was craving a French speaking kind of star player, a guy that, you know, they could, you know, maybe the French fans could rally around or something like that. But he was given a lot of attention and affirmation and ice time and opportunity very early, very quickly. And he was young. I think he might have been a teenager then. And that's hard. Now, that's hard to deal with. I don't care if there was no Twitter, like, you know, the internet was still kind of, you know, social media didn't exist like it does now. It's a lot. And it's a lot to kind of just stay grounded and realize that it's going to be a really hard journey, even though, you know, there are some good moments there. And, you know, he's a big, strong, heavy kid, and he'd run into guys and he had some big hits. I remember he hurt someone really bad. Robbie DeMaio. Yes.
Rob DeMaio.
Remember that. Absolutely. But yeah, he got DeMaio in a clean hit and rang his head off the glass. And,
That was in training camp.
Training camp, yeah. But you know, he had a.
That was an exhibition game.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And he had a weird little snapshot that he could beat goalies from, kind of, and pretty good hands in tight. He was too heavy to be fast, so he had to be kind of quick and nimble for a big guy. But it really, I think for him, it was just, and I don't know how you prevent this. Like I you know, if he was clearly good enough to be in the NHL. You know, he scored 16 goals in 80 games. Like, that's pretty good for a 19-year-old. But
right.
So I don't know how you say, well, you can't play him there. But I don't know how you protect someone from the onslaught of attention that he received. I mean, he was all over the place. Every newspaper, every TV show led off with him. He was doing ads. He was head of the telephone. All great stuff. It's just a lot. And it's hard not to kind of have it go to your head a little bit and get you thinking that you're pretty good and maybe just that you've got it made when you're still figuring it out. So that is a challenge, not unique to Montreal, although the French thing is unique to Montreal. But you know, I was a rookie in Toronto 10 years prior. I led all rookies in scoring. Like, when I'm driving downtown and like my parents could see a billboard with my picture on it, or my sister walks in the Nike store and there's like a 40-foot poster of me. Like, that's weird. It's awesome, but it's weird. And I was 22 at the time, let alone 19. So it's just one of the unique challenges when you play in a big market as a young player. But yeah, I remember him, and I remember just, I don't think there was animosity towards him for how much he received early, but it just, you could tell it was going to be a lot. It might be too much.
But did it create, in his case or any other situation that you might have lived with young players, being given ample opportunities and being like, given more than their fair share of attention, does it create any sort of friction within the team?
No, not really. I mean, no. Well, yeah, they're occasionally, like, they're, you might get like the odd comments, or you might, like, you know, have the group or the room trying to like knock him down a couple pegs just to kind of keep him even keel. If you think he's floating above the world and, you know, he's not going to stay out there and work on his game because he's got to do a commercial for Ford. Like, you're like, hey, less Ford, more skating. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there are comments like that made. Not specifically just for Guy, but you know, I remember Chris Kalanos was a really highly touted guy in Arizona, and he scored the overtime game winning national championship winning goal at Boston College's freshman year. And he came in and he carried himself like, I am the man, which was part of what makes him good, right? Like, he came in and we're like, hey, Chris, he's like, nah, it's Special K. We're like, what? He's like, you can call me Special K. I'm like, I think I'm just going to call you Chris for now. But, like, you know, and so, like, you kind of have that. That's how the rooms regulate themselves to try to make sure that no one gets too far ahead of the game. And, it happens. It happens. It's almost not even a fault of Latondres or Kalanos or whoever, Mike Johnson in Toronto. It's just almost inevitable, but ideally the room can kind of patrol it enough to keep him on even keel, or his parents or support or whoever else is around him at those first couple of years.
The balance between confidence and cockiness, it's such a thin line, that it might, on the one hand, you need all that confidence so that you can develop and exploit your abilities to their maximum. But at the same time, if you tip on the other side and you show cockiness, that's I guess it can rub a lot of people the wrong way. So how difficult is this to maintain that line?
Well, I guess we're splitting hairs, but if I were to advise a young kid, and I've spoken to prospect camps, I would say this: on the ice, be cocky, believe in yourself, don't defer, don't be scared, don't be bashful, believe in yourself, whatever it is you think you're good at, bring it, and bring it with attitude. Off the ice, be confident in yourself, but maintain a level of humility, especially an outward level of humility, that people will pick up on. Now, you can still believe in yourself and have confidence, and if someone's going to ask you, do you belong in the NHL, and you're 19, like, yes, I think I have lots to learn here, but I think I'm good enough to play, and I look forward to getting better as the year goes on. And, you know, off the ice, humble and confident. On the ice, as cocky as you want to be, no one's going to care, because if that's what it takes for you to play your best, then do it. You'll never bother one of your teammates by being cocky on the ice if that's what gets your best performance.
That's perfectly said, because that's exactly what's so difficult about the line, is keeping the cockiness on the ice. It's hard not to take it off. I'm glad you brought up speaking of prospect camps, because we did want to kind of pick your brain on sort of ideal player development models. I think we've been trying to figure out, especially in Montreal over the last couple of years, you know, most recently the Canadiens deciding to, I guess, suggest to Cole Caulfield that he should go back to college for a second year after
after. Isn't that strange? Because teams always, even if you don't think he's going to play in the NHL, teams want them under their control. Like, we want you in our system and in our control. And to say, no, go back to college where, you know, we're kind of hands off and all the NCAA regulations. That
I found it strange as well.
Yeah, it's unusual.
Well, is it possible that it's because they might be concerned that he might spend the first year of his entry-level deal in the AHL, and they would rather have him for a full 3 years at the NHL level, and they'll wait until he's ready for the NHL before, you know, invite him over?
100%. I think it's asset management. I think it's term contract entry-level management. I think you're absolutely correct in that they don't see him playing in the NHL next year. So if that's not going to be the case, then go play college again, and we'll revisit this after the second year. The only danger you run into, and you know where I'm going with this, you get 2 years in, and let's say next year he doesn't play great. I don't know. He can score like every time he goes on the ice, it seems. But you start bumping in that wall. If he doesn't like Montreal, or he doesn't love the respect they're giving him by sending him back to college if he wanted to come out, well, now he's just 2 more years away from saying, I can go play anywhere I want.
Yeah.
So there is that dynamic. If you play your 4 years, then you become an unrestricted free agent, which is still 2 years away, but it's that much closer, and he's that much further into school. Maybe he gets into academically, he sees a degree on the horizon. Who knows? Maybe they have a good team, win a championship, whatever happens. So there is a risk involved by giving up the control you could have had if you pulled them out.
Yeah, there is that. I think the one aspect of asset management that a lot of people don't talk about is that teams like to stagger their entry level contracts, so that because now, yeah, like yeah, exactly. Like you can run into a situation like Toronto had, and have to pay everyone all at once, and it creates a situation that it did. Whereas I think they wanted to have him be a little bit further away from Kotkaniemi and Suzuki and the other guys.
How much money is Kotkaniemi going to make out of his entry-level deal?
Good question.
Like, not a lot.
We've been trying to figure, well, who knows? I mean, the thing is, like,
I mean, like, what do you mean? Like, what, like, if he plays in the NHL next year,
yeah.
And I mean, that's, I'm assuming he will. Like, if he puts up, what would be a good year for him next year? Like, I know he's scoring well at the minor league before everything got stopped up and he got hurt.
Let's say 55 points.
So 55 points would be a pretty good year for him, right?
That would be a great year. I wouldn't expect any more than that.
He's not going to play in front of Suzuki, and he's not going to play in front of Deneau. So you got to remember ice time. Like, he, you know, Suzuki's going to be the power play guy going forward. And that Deneau line, I'm sorry, they are just so so good together. Like, I don't know how you can change it. So if he's going to play center, he's playing third line center. And that's even if Max Domi doesn't play center anymore. So if he wants to play center, where you drafted him to play, big body, reliable two-way guy, he's going to be your third line center. How many third line centers get 55 points in the NHL?
No, not a lot.
Not many. So let's just say, best case scenario, third line center, everyone stays healthy, 20 goals, 50 points. So 50 points after a year where you're sent to the minors, that's going to get him a bridge deal for $2.75 million a year. Like, I don't think that he's going to break the bank, even if he has a good year next year.
Yeah, no, you might be right. But what I think what they have to do planning-wise is what happens if he explodes next year? Like, I mean, it could happen. Like, it's, you know, you look at a lot of guys who entered the league at 18, the third year of their entry-level deal is when they figure it out, in a lot of cases.
Sure.
So if that happens, because everything you said is correct. Like, he will, in all likelihood, be the third-line center, and if he were to hit 50 points, it would be somewhat of a miracle, although I would imagine he'd get significant power play time even if he was on the third line, but still.
Yep.
But I think when just bringing it back to the whole Caulfield and planning thing is like, okay, well, what if that doesn't happen? What if he actually does come in and have a kick-ass season and really becomes a legitimate top six center and gets, I don't know, 65, 70 points? I mean, who knows?
Sure.
If that happens, then having Caulfield come out of entry level a year later, you know, I mean, I don't know. I haven't actually done the math on it, but like there is that aspect of it that I think a lot of fans don't realize where the Toronto experience has opened the eyes of a lot of front offices in this league where they do not want to run into a situation like that.
And the danger of letting your third year guys, if they look like they're going to be really good, get through their third year.
Exactly.
But Suzuki, let's say Suzuki goes next year and I don't think it's a stretch at all if he plays 80 games, is able to stay healthy, that he puts up 65 plus points. Right? Right. I don't think that's a massive stretch. So then do you sign him after 2 years? Or do you let him play his third and go get 80 points? And all of a sudden, you know, the $6 million contract is an $8.5 million contract. And you're right. So that's where, you know, Cole Caulfield comes out. And I don't want to compare him to DeBrincat just because they're both short. But DeBrincat had two great years. He signed a massive contract after his couple of good scoring years. And they had to get him done early. So, yes, there is all these different things you need to worry about when you're running your team as far as, you know, player development, just trying to get them to be the best they can be, but also the timing of it so that you can manage your finances as best you can. So, I mean, I guess it's a problem that Montreal hopes they can have. I mean, it'd be great news if Kotkaniemi forced him into a bad contract because he got 60 points.
Right.
Yeah, but at the same time, you say, well, if Kotkaniemi ends up scoring 55 points, he'll get a bridge deal at 2.75. That's one figure, but they could also decide that, you know what? He's demonstrated to us that he's back on the right path in the proper development curve that we're hoping to see from him, and because of that, we're ready to give him a long term contract, and then that's a significant higher figure than that.
Sure, it is, and you can hit a home run like you can go say, let's get him into a Brendan Gallagher deal where you know we sign him to a long term deal, and boy, we're getting value year after year after year on it because he outperforms it. And like that's all part of the conversation. But even if they were going to our hypothetical world where he has a great 55 point year and he wants a 5-year deal, he's not going to get $5 million a year. Not after a year where he played in the minors and he then came the next year and got 50 points. Like, I don't think he gets that. I think he maybe gets somewhere around $380 a year, $19 million, which again, it's not bad value. You can do that. But I guess I'm just saying, I don't see Kotkaniemi In any scenario, as much as I like him as a player, garnering a contract for more than $5 million on a short or long term deal after next year, given what's happened this year.
Well, who knows? Maybe that down the road, that time spent at Laval might be a blessing in disguise for the Canadiens.
I'm not saying it was a mistake. I'm like, well, financially as well, but I'm not saying letting him down there, letting him play, get some confidence, because you saw him kind of get like. I didn't mind when he played as an 18-year-old because I'm like, you know what? He's not hurting you defensively. Like, he was smart enough defensively that he was learning on the fly, but not really costing you. And it looked like, you know, his offensive game would grow and develop. And so I didn't mind that because, you know, the defensive side, he wasn't getting caved in. It wasn't overwhelming. It wasn't getting bullied around out there. But then I watched this year, and I don't know if his health was right the entire season. But if there's one thing And maybe it's health and it's probably confidence. They may, you know, and everything in his game this year became slower. And that's the issue to me for him. Like, not only his foot speed became slower, but his decision-making became slower. Like, we'd be doing games early, and you could tell he wasn't sure where to move it. And by the time he decided where he wanted to go with it, he'd be caught and stripped. And you're like, that wasn't happening last year. So that might be confidence, but he's got to turn up the tempo of all parts of his games if he wants to be a good offensive NHLer. And I think some of that also is foot speed. Maybe it's strength. Maybe it's physical maturity, like just going through the late stages of puberty, whatever it might be. But that's got to be his project for the summer. Explosive power, speed, and ramping up his mind as well.
Right. Yeah, because I think the word you're looking for is he was tentative. Like, that was like he was – everything he did, he seemed to need to think about for like half a second.
He double clutched. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's exactly what he was. Like, if you could go through a highlight reel of his rookie season and count the number of, like, quick one-touch passes he made in the neutral zone to make sure the puck got through there. And that's what jumped out to me watching him. I was like, this guy thinks like a veteran already. Mm. And he's 18. And then he wasn't doing that anymore. So, I mean, that's, I think all the issues, like, he was not healthy pretty much all season. And the Canadians have kind of questioned his preparation for training camp. But all of that, the whole, everything sort of conspired to, like, just crush his confidence, like, very early on this season, which at 19 would be, you know, which is exactly the age that Latendresse was when you played with him.
Yeah.
Would be tough to handle, you know.
Yeah, listen, I would be 27 going through a prolonged goal scoring slump, and I'm like, I hate hockey. I'm the worst player of all time, like, let alone, you know, and you're 8 years in the league. Like, you know, you think you should be able to ride through the rough patches. So I have great sympathy, but I do think, you know, the confidence and the mental acuity will come back, like, because he showed it. Like, you don't lose that when you're 19. But, you know, working on his body, getting stronger, that's what he's got to take take the next level, to be able to play with the kind of pace that would make him so much more effective. You can think and you can pass, because he can pass quite well. Then if you can skate and get there, that's a pretty good combination.
We asked a similar question to Marc Denis last week, but and I'll ask it to you. We just talked about Kotkaniemi. You referred to Suzuki earlier. How realistic in your mind can it be to see the Canadians being a successful team, getting valuable years from Weber and Price, and having it like coming in sync with Kotkaniemi and Suzuki being like significant contributors on the team? How realistic is that those two generations can you know, come together?
Intersect. Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it boils down to, so I'm going to give Shea Weber two more years of good play before 36, his body, his weight. I think he'll start to slow down more significantly at that point. So I'm giving him two more years. Carey, I have to be able to give him four more years. Like, it's a bad model if I'm trying to plug him only being good for a couple more, because he's got seven more on the contract, whatever it is. So, you know, three or four more at his very best. Do you believe that Suzuki and Kotkaniemi can become that kind of impact player in the next 2 years? Is basically what it boils down to, because I think that's the window. And Suzuki, I say yes. Kotkaniemi, I don't know if I can't say yes with confidence. I say it's possible, but Suzuki, yes. I mean, I think Nick Suzuki will be the number one offensive player on the team next year. I think he will be the number one center, even though if he doesn't play with Tatar and Gallagher, you know, as far as when they need a goal, he'll be the guy they look to. So I'm okay saying he'll get there in the next year or two. You look at the numbers he put up historically, like what he did in Guelph and in the playoffs. And, you know, he has proven himself to be an elite level producer all the way along. And RP would know this, but like whatever he had the last 40 games, did he have 33 points? Like whatever it was, like it was a pretty good number. That would if you know you double that, he was on a 60 plus point pace the last 40 games he played. So, well,
basically, as soon as he became a top six guy, he started.
Yeah, once he started playing with players in that role, so he'll get there. Kotkaniemi, I'm not sure for the reasons we just talked about, and because I think opportunity. He's not going to get a top six role. Like Phil Deneau is a really good player, and don't I know? We circle of life back to when I played in Montreal. Like I played on the third line. I never played in the power play. I think I was second or third on the team in like 5-on-5 scoring, but I was way down the scoring list. So if you don't play with scorers if you don't play in scoring situations, if you don't play on the power play, not only do you not get the points that go along with those roles and players, you don't get the confidence boosting cookies and candy that you need to sustain yourself when you don't play well. And when you don't get the greasy second assist on a power play, and now you're all of a sudden no points in five games instead of squeezing in that one in the middle where it doesn't feel so bad. Like it does matter. Even though you're not playing any differently, it matters to you psychologically. It matters to your confidence. And I don't know if Kotkaniemi will get all that extra goodies in the next couple of years. Yeah, Phil Deneau has one more year, so maybe they let him go after next year. I don't know, because he's going to deserve a big pay raise. I'm not sure what happens with him, but I don't think Kotkaniemi will have the opportunity to become a really impactful offensive guy next year, for sure, maybe the year after.
And plus, hearing what you're saying with that five-game, you know, point drought, if there's one kid whose validation comes directly from goals and assists and nothing else, it's Jesperi Kotkaniemi. That's all he thinks about. Mm. It's incredible. Like, I mean,
he's not alone.
Play a really... he's not alone. Yeah. Of course they are, but like, he will play an objectively really good game, you know, mm-hmm. and I'll tell him as much. I was like, I thought that game against New Jersey the other night was really good. He's like, what? I got two shots on goal. I had no points at this. I was like, geez, okay. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, but you know, you were out there against these, you know, whatever. I'll bring up like my arguments. And he thinks that it's all bullshit. No, I got no points. This is, it's not good. If I don't score, and if I'm not on the ice when we score, then mm-hmm. I have no value to the team, which is I guess a good attitude to have in the sense, in a way. But yeah. I think it can also lead to these dips in confidence that we saw this year. Like, it's like, that's the kind of mentality that can make you feel like you hate hockey and you never want to play again, like you were saying earlier.
Any top fix feels that way, because you don't get picked in the top 10 because you're a good two-way guy. You get picked because you're an offensive dynamo. And that's how, you know, that's why you're on the World Junior team, not because you're good in your own end. You're good because you put in the net. Now, once you get a bit older, even if you're an offensive guy, you come to realize the ebbs and the flows. There'll be some dry spells. There'll be some hot spells. Worry about the process more than the result. It's just impossible. Listen, if I could tell you how many times I ran the numbers on like my goal scoring rates, my assist rates, my point rates. Okay. Okay. I have 4 and 10. Shoot. I got to pick it up now if I want to get to 50. Like, I would know them all the time. It was exhausting. Wow. And I did that almost my whole career. So I am sensitive to, you know, the pressure that you feel when you want to play offensively, you want to produce, you always have, but you're not good enough to know that you're going to get, like, he's not Austin Matthews. Like he's not always going to score. He's not good enough. No. He's not that kind of player. So, you know, it's going to be a grind on him unless he kind of can smooth out some of those dips.
Yeah, I agree. Anyhow, it's funny. Like, you know, we talk about this team now and these are the guys that we're talking about. You know, I just did a mailbag and all you get are questions about Cole Caulfield and Kotkaniemi and Suzuki and all this. Like, it's just, it's the question that Marc-Antoine asked before is so pertinent because this team is built around these two guys, but what everyone is talking about and thinking about and really how the organization is building itself is through this other generation of guys who are two generations removed almost from their main guys. Yep. So, but your insight on it is so valuable, you know,
because it seems as though the actual team, the guys that are already, you know, that are already the young veterans on this team, it looks as though this actual team has plateaued. So that's why the fans are focusing on the young players, because they're the ones that can bring legitimate hope. And yeah, and to that extent, to find, like,
yeah, where do we get better? How do we get better?
Right.
Because Brendan Gallagher is not going to get much better. He's awesome. Like, I'm not saying he's not, don't take that as he's not good. He's amazing. Like, how much better is he going to get? I don't think he can get much better. He's already great. Thomas Tatar having a career year. I think Philip Deneau, one of the most underrated players in the NHL, like, he's not going to get better because he's already really, really good. So where does the growth come from? And that's a tricky one to answer, because I look at their defense and that's the rub. Like, Ben Chiarot had a really good year in Montreal. Better than I thought he would.
The help is really far away. Like, that's the thing.
Well, that's what, like,
the help on defense is far. Where's it coming from?
There's only Romanoff. Romanoff is the one. The one that's coming. Yeah.
So, I mean, and you know what? You mix someone in your top four, it can make a big difference. Slotting, everyone gets pushed down a little bit. You get Weber, Petrie, Romanoff, Like, I don't, you know, is Victor Mete, like, you know, a top four contributor on a really good team? Hopefully, hopefully. He hasn't been yet, but that's the question that, you know, that Mark Bergevin tries to grind over. Like, where do you, how do you support those guys? Because a lot of guys are playing about as well as you can conceivably hope for them to play, and you're still not there. That's challenging.
I have a question for you. You've heard all scenarios that are floating around when hockey will be able to resume. God knows when this is going to be, and it's obviously far down the priority list right now for everybody. But the league is looking through its own scope and they're analyzing different scenarios, and one of which, probably in order to salvage some of the revenues that will have been lost in the meantime, is to include a larger number of teams in the playoffs, and they go a certain scenario, a certain possibility is going as far as including 24 teams in the playoffs, which would include the Montreal Canadiens as the 24th team. Is there any good for this team? You know, if you think of how long these players will have been without playing, any momentum or rhythm that a good team might have been on, it'll have to be rediscovered because everybody lost their momentum. So it's going to be a matter of who gets it first, who finds it first. So in that sense, if there was to be a 24 playoff team format, is there any good that the Canadians could get out of that? Or they should hope that they're excluded of that and they keep a high draft pick?
Well, I mean, I guess I would look at it this way. I mean, even if they allow 24 in, assume that they don't win the lottery, their draft pick will stay the same. Like, they'll still pick whatever they are, seventh or eighth, whatever it is in the league. So I don't think I take the opportunity, because it's not going to, if you're not going to win the lottery, which, you know, we assume they won't, then you're not really going to cost yourself by making the playoffs. So might as well get in there and maybe Carey Price catches lightning in the bottle. Everyone's starting from scratch. Who knows what happens if they're able to get in there. But I'll say this. If you have enough time, if the league has enough time to play a playoff that involves 24 teams, then I would just rather you play everyone to 76 games. If logistically you can, and your arenas are open and it's not all in one centralized location, or, you know, who knows how they might have to quarantine the players if they want to try to do this. But let's just say they're back in rinks. I'd rather play everyone 5, 6, 7 more games, 2 weeks, than add another round of playoffs and then just let the top 8 teams make it. And then just go to 16 teams, and you don't have to worry about making it crazy. Now, if you can't do that, as much as I love Montreal and I want Montreal to make it, I don't think it's necessarily super fair that they're involved in the playoffs, because they're so far out of it. They're not realistically a contender. They won't be shortchanged by not finishing the season. They were never going to make the playoffs. If it was me, if I had to start up with no more regular season games, I would allow 10 teams per conference to make it, based on points percentage. So you'd have those couple teams jump at the top of the, at the 7, 8, 9, 10 spots, but you won't be knocked right out, and let 10 play 7, 8 play 9. And I don't know if it's 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5, and then go into the full playoffs. That's what I would do, just to for those teams right on the bubble, right chasing. You think of the Islanders and the Rangers and those teams that are right on it, Vancouver, Minnesota, that they get their chance that they might've been able to earn had they played a little bit longer. You go down to 24 teams, like Chicago's not, not going to make the playoffs. No. Montreal's not making, they don't deserve to really be part of that tournament. So I would go
for sure
20. If I had more time, then I would just play more regular season games and cap it at 74, 76, and then just let 8 teams in if I could do it.
Yeah. Well, trust me, I'm pretty sure Montreal's on board with what you just said. I think they think they have a better chance of winning the lottery than they would have winning the first round of any hypothetical playoff series. So
teams in though, right? So there's 12 per conference, that they would be the 8. They would be the 12 seed. They'd have to play, what, the 5 seed in the first round, I guess, to advance, right? Because one
top four teams would have a bye.
They would play each other. So they're playing, who's the 5th best team in the conference? It would be Pittsburgh. Is that right? Yeah, Pittsburgh.
That could be right. Yeah.
So, I mean, could they beat Pittsburgh in a 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5? Like, yeah, of course.
Well, 2 out of 3, anyone could. Yeah.
I mean, I'm saying, could. Like, they're probably not, if you go to 24 teams, you're not playing 7-game series, all those different, you're not playing 5, 7-game series, right? If you have to, if you're a play-in team, so you're gonna, that first one's gonna be 3 of 5 or 2 of 3. So yeah, like play 2 of 3 and all 3 are in Pittsburgh. Yeah, like
yeah,
It could absolutely happen. It's not out of the question at all. So that's the puncher's chance that every team, and not just because they have Carey, that's not their punch. Any team in a short series off of, what, 4 or 5 months off? Who knows what's going to happen? Yeah. So, I could see, like, you know what, put us in the playoffs. We'll take our 7th, 8th pick and we'll have the best of both worlds.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I don't know. I do agree that it's inherently unfair. Because they do need to come up with a mechanism. Like, I think if you went by points percentage, the Winnipeg Jets would be out by 1/1000th of a point. Yeah, it's 0.001 right now. So, anyhow, Mike, we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for hanging with us and sharing your thoughts on Alexander Perejogan. It's really, really appreciated. And we look forward to hearing you back on the air when we have games again at some point. God knows when that will.
I appreciate that. And looking forward to get back to normalcy at some point as well. All right. You guys stay safe, wash your hands, and stay away from everybody. And we'll talk again soon. Merci beaucoup.
So that was a really interesting conversation there with Mike Johnson, obviously of TSN, who does color commentary for not only the Canadiens, but a number of other teams. But was really great to hear his insight. I was just wondering if there's one thing he said that stood out to you over the course of that conversation.
Well, one of the things that stood out to me is the confidence that he seems to have in Nick Suzuki and becoming a dominant player soon as next year. It speaks, I think, volume about the what Suzuki has been able to showcase this past season for Mike to come in and say, well, I picture him as being the first line center at some point next season and being a 65-point guy. And just in the same breath after we had just spoken about Kotkaniemi, who just is a great reminder of how the second season pro can be risky and you can take a step back. So to hear him say with so much confidence that Suzuki is indeed going to be that player, I thought it was really interesting. And if he's right, it just bodes very well for the future.
Yeah. My favorite part was hearing about his only training camp with the Canadiens and how the Mike Ribeiro trade, like just hearing about the Mike Ribeiro for Yanni Nienema trade brought me back so many wonderful memories of just thinking of what a monumentally terrible trade that was. But in any case, hearing how his first impressions of Thomas Plekanec and all that stuff is, I found really great. And it was great to be able to hear him. You really understand why he's so good at his job when he talks about how he prepares to do his job and what he aims to do in a broadcast booth. And I think, it's a lot of people would have a lot to learn from him in that regard, because that is what viewers want from an analyst, is for them to explain the why and exactly as he said. So that was really great.
Canadian fans are spoiled with Marc Denis and Mike Johnson, you know, on the French side, the English side. I mean, those are top-notch colorman. It doesn't get much better than that in the business.
Yeah, and the other thing that I appreciate about Mike Johnson is when I run into him in various rinks, and as he said, he always reads up on it, so he will always make a point of coming to me and telling me and commenting to me on a story that I wrote recently or a thought that he had based on something he read. And, you know, it's always nice to know that someone's reading what you write. So that's another reason I like that.
Except that he always says that he's terrible, right?
Yes, exactly. He always points out what I did wrong. No, that's false. Actually, he's very, very nice, and just wants to go further into a point I would try to make or whatever. And which is a perfect segue that if you know any of you are listening and would be interested in reading what we write, not only us but everyone across the Athletic Network, we have two great options for you. First of all, you could subscribe at a 40% off discount at theathletic.com/athletic support. That's theathletic.com/athletic support, all one word. And you also, if you would just like to try us out, because there are no games right now, but we're still producing tons and tons of great stuff. We just finished Sports Movie Week with this amazing story. Seth Davis today wrote a story updating us on the main protagonist from Hoop Dreams, William Gates and Arthur Agee. And and it was riveting. I was riveted by it because I wanted to know what those guys. Anyhow, we have tons of great stuff like that, even though there are no games right now. And you can get a free 90-day trial if you're a new subscriber to try us out for 3 months and then make your decision whether you want to stick around. And I'm sure after 3 months, you will be inclined to stick around. So so that you can get that offer just by essentially clicking on any story on The Athletic. You will get an option to sign up, and a free 90-day trial will be offered automatically. But if you want to sign up right away and you know that you want to and you want 40% off the subscription price, theathletic.com/athletic support.
There you go. And on the local side, we've got there's a nice feature today from Sean Gordon describing how Lafreniere is training in his garage right now with being unable to go to any gym or to on the ice anywhere. So how he prepares physically for the upcoming draft. Yesterday, our colleague Marc Dumont was also writing a very compelling human story on Michael McNiven, who grew up basically without his parents and how he learned to cope with that and found a sanctuary in playing hockey to overcome those difficulties. So it was it's two different type of articles, but equally worth reading. So and we've got pretty good content coming up. We got a couple of articles that you and I will co-sign. So I always write doing those. It's always fun.
And we're gonna do our sort of off-season deep dives on some decisions the Canadians have to make and how they should be approaching them. So stay tuned for that next week and in the coming weeks. But as always, we're going to try and continue pumping out the material for you guys to hear it. And we will be back on this platform in podcast form in French, sur Le Sport Athlétique, next Friday. And we'll see what we have in store. We don't know yet. So
we don't know, but if we have a guest, I hope that my microphone will work enough so that I can say goodbye to our guest at the end, because I was not able to do that to Mike. It might have sounded rude. I think I'll have to text him and say, "Hey, pal, I didn't mean anything by that. It's just my microphone."
I'm sure Mike took no offense. But anyhow, until next week, thanks for listening, thanks for reading, and thanks for being with us during this time. And I'd like just to remind everyone to please stay safe and listen to what the authorities are telling us to do. And just stay home and stay out of trouble. Thanks very much.
Thank you, everybody. Bye-bye. Thank you.